And welcome, ladies and gentlemen, and to another edition of Warrior Connection. Well, we got another warm, sunny day here in Illinois. I don't know what the weather's like out in Denver, but Denise, you'd like to discuss something as we enter our program tonight, wouldn't you? Denise, are you there? Okay. Well, we'll wait for a moment, and hopefully Denise will be joining us. Ladies and gentlemen, there's been a lot of talk and a lot of discussion, again, about chemical warfare, biological warfare in the news over the last few days. And again, there's a lot of discussion whether or not the United States should intervene in Syria, because the claims are, and things have been said, that supposedly in Syria, poison gas and chemical agents have been used. And I think we need to go back to the fundamentals tonight and have a discussion about that, about what nuclear biological chemical warfare is, what it consists of, what's happening, what are the probable uses of it, what are the medical requirements, or what are decontamination. All these are a whole host of different things that have been involved with everything for quite a while. Denise, are you here by chance yet? Okay, well, I talked to Denise a few minutes ago, and she'll hopefully come on. One thing we want to look at, when we look at all the different chemical agents, there's a whole host of different families. One of the things is nerve agents. And nerve agents, again, first off, are not gases. Let's understand this right off the bat. This is one of the things that's been out there and people don't understand. They're not gases, they're liquids. Whether you have VX or you have sarin, or if you have cyclosarin, if you have Tibune, Novichok, Multiple 7, any of these are all liquids. And when they're dispersed, the way they are dispersed is they can have it in a bomblet form where it's spread. Again, the canister is open. You can use explosives to open it up, but what you want to do is spread out the liquid all over the place. One thing that was done when it was used in Tokyo in the subways, they put it into a baggie, put the sarin into the baggie, and basically just jumped on it. And we had a very limited distribution of it at that time. But all these are the different things that we've run into problems with. And understanding how this is all used, what happens when it's used, and everything else. When you have a liquid, as are the nerve agents, they can be dispersed. One of the ways we know they were dispersed during Operation Desert Storm by the Iraqis is you can have a sprayer. In other words, they mounted on the back of the Jeep, and they just went around and sprayed it. Sort of like the old bug sprayers that you see going around in your community and everything like that. That was one of the problems we had. The other thing you could take and spray it, put it into, say, for example, a container like you're going to kill bugs in around your house, or spray weeds or anything and spray it all over again. These are liquids that are dispersed into a mist and everything else that comes on out. Now, when the nerve agent is used, what it affects is the neurological system, the system functions and everything. First thing that you'll see is pinpointed pupils. The other thing, you'll have some respiratory distress. You'll start seeing individuals running into problems with their neural functioning. In other words, they've lost coordination. They start stumbling and all these different things. See, these are a whole host of different things that you're going to see. The rest of stuff, again, the various thing comes out, the meiosis, a pinpoint of the pupils, the rhinorrhea. Rhinorrhea, this is where the nose starts running. You have breathing and difficulty breathing and everything. You might have loss of consciousness, convulsions, you'll have respiratory problems, you have flaccid paralysis, you'll have copious secretions. Okay, again, this is all the different things that are going to happen. This is a liquid, not a gas. This is a liquid that's dispersed all over the place. And you can inhale it and get the liquid down into your lungs and all over. You get the liquid on your skin and it's absorbed rapidly. So a whole host of different things are going to happen. Denise, are you here by chance yet?
Yes, I am.
Okay.
And one of the things you didn't mention yet that I don't think you mentioned was the Regal report and Jim Tewitt's report about a year ago with Dr. Haley. And what was interesting in the Regal report, that was the banking committee on the Senate side back in May 24th, 1994.
A long time ago.
Yeah. Was the interesting portions of that, I found, was not only in the report, but the appendices, and talking about the temperature on sarin, and that it wouldn't actually burn up, that it would disperse.
Correct.
And so that was a lot of problem in the Gulf War, is the dispersion.
Yeah, and it went for a long ways. It didn't stay in an immediate area. We're talking with the incomplete combustion and the destruction, well, there's over 105 sites, not just Kamosiya. But this stuff went hundreds of miles, hundreds of kilometers.
And the good old DOD tried to go out to the Dugway Proving Ground, I think it was, up in Utah.
Yeah, the Skull Valley incident.
And I'm sorry, but you can't recreate the winds and the higher altitude winds when you're trying to recreate in Utah. The wind patterns in Saudi and Iraq are significantly different during that time. And one of the things that Jim Tewitt has done is continue that work with this dispersion and how it travels. So he and Dr. Haley had two separate publications in the same journal within the past year, and really comparing it kind of to the atomic blast and how it circulates back down with the blast. And the other problem we had during the Gulf War, and we need to find out for sure if they've used protostigmine bromide, OIF, OEF. I've gotten conflicting reports on that usage. You can also, you know, they used old shells for the IEDs, and they, you know, had markings on them.
Yeah, there was incredible complex problems with the total misuse of pesticides and everything else, and the protostigmine bromide. I think you were in a hearing in Congress when we were presenting the information right out of the Army manual that confirmed over 50% casualties from the use of preosinamide bromide PB tablets, which are carbamate-based pesticide themselves. So once you took it, you were absolutely interfering with your neural functioning, but it was given as a precursor for the exposure to all of the other nerve agents with the idea that if you got zapped, the PB would lock up the synaptic junctions such that the antidotes would work.
And what they were talking about in those early hearings, and you're referring to Congressman Boyer's hearing, I think it was, way back, House VA committee. But one of the things that came up during Congressman Shea's government reform committee, when he was having so many hearings on the Gulf War illnesses and also on anthrax vaccine, there was some mention, a couple of things hit me just right in the face about the second meeting, was the DOD said there was no acute symptoms. The other thing that hit me was the potential that the PB would have masked our symptoms that we had.
Yeah, that was a finding that, again, and was very interesting because the Navy Seabees, who were part and parcel of the research that Bob Haley did, I mean, they definitely got hit by a Scud attack with the chemical in it, okay? And they had all the medical problems right then and there. So we knew that was, and we knew the area was contaminated once that happened. And then when Bob Haley got into actually doing the studies, he found the problems in the brain that proved that the exposures happened. And I know on our own cases, I know on my own MRI, a special MRI they did down in Dallas, Texas, that it showed up. So you got all of these incredible exposures, and again, these are liquids, not gases. But, you know, before we continue on with the discussion of, you know, the chemical and biological agents, all the stuff and all the exposures, the veterans are just totally frustrated with the lack of medical care, the lack of response, whether they're trying to get care for post-traumatic stress problems, if they're trying to get medical care directly for the physiological problems. And as a consequence, the veterans can step over the edge, can't they?
Yes, they can. I wanted to mention two things. Number one is all through the 23 years we've had two things we want to mention here. We've had a surge of interest with Gulf War vets. I think it's almost like teenagers. You want to be invincible and not have anything damage you. And, you know, we train the troops to be tough and not to complain. So a lot of complaints that they may have had in theater were never documented. And then they, you know, kind of suck it up and keep trying to go forward. I mean, we're, you know, every time I turn around, we have a new peak of interest of vets that have said, you know, I've had these problems, I've ignored them, should I put a claim in? The answer is yes. Get your claims in. We've had the presumptive extended till 2016, and it's really important to get in there. The thing with the VA is they have not educated the doctors. The veterans claims people at the Veterans Administration rating offices, there's a very big difference in what somebody gets up in Michigan or Kansas or Florida or Colorado or California. There needs to be some standardization. There needs to be some education. And that also includes the veteran service organizations where people turn for help. Of educating the veteran service organizations that are helping people with their claims. The other problem is just the lack of, what should I say, Doug? And it starts at the top, it goes all throughout the system, the lack of really taking accountability and responsibility, acknowledging the vets are sick, not telling them it's psychological or it's stress or downplaying it. But to really dig into it and show the true caring. They don't get it from the VA. The claims are backed up, as we know, Vietnam. All of them are backed up.
Yeah, I think the latest claim count right now is still over 750,000 backlog in the VBA.
Yeah, and they keep saying the automation will help. But please, vets, if you have noticed changes in your health since the war, yes, you need to go in and get your claim in. And yes, it's agonizing, it's frustrating, it creates stress. When you're finally admitting that you have a problem and going forward and not getting the appropriate response, it is terrible, but that's the way it is. We're working on trying to get them to listen to us. I know that there's a petition out to remove Shinseki because of the backlog. I really think that we should have a petition for the way the Gulf War vets have been treated. Desert Storm vets are getting to be very much like Korean vets and forgotten. And it's sad. It's terrible. The vets get down. They're having pain. They're having chronic fatigue. I don't call it chronic fatigue. I say it's exertional. It's not an equal response as to what's normal. You try to go out and be normal, and you pay the price by a week later. You're still not doing well if you exert any effort. So it's a overwhelming fatigue pattern in response to any normal living task.
I know one of the things that hit me yesterday. Yesterday we had the half century of Farm Progress Show here in Rantoul, Illinois at the old Chanute Airfield. And as a part of this, we put a dunk booth up in order to raise money to build a veteran's memorial on the former Chanute Air Force Base that'll, you know, be in honor of all veterans. It's not just Rantoul area, but all veterans that have come through Chanute Air Force Base, which is all branches. And as a part of this, when I was up in the dunk tank, I mean, the kids were, wait a minute, how old are you? And, you know, what have you done? And I'm up there, you know, on the dunk tank in my swimming suit and getting dunked in over and over and over again and then climbing out of that thing and climbing back up. The
effect on my arm yesterday,
and then my temperature was erratic, and so, I mean, today I've been definitely feeling it.
Yes, a lot of people overdo it. They go out, and they feel like they're on a mission to help or do something, and they overdo it. And you're one that leads the crowd on that, Doug, sorry to say, but it's you've got to readjust your lifestyle and adapt to it. And you're going to pay the price when you go out and interact. One of the things is that I want to talk to people about is that the Gulf War vets have become what I've always called, and I told Senator Kerry's person, staffer, this many, many, many times I've used this, of they're bunkered in. They need help, and it's like no one's answering the radio communications of we need help. It's like it's ignored, it's not answered. And they become bunkered in, they become more isolated. There's no effort by state to get them to even have meetups. The Vietnam vets, were really great at forming reunion groups and meeting. I mean, there's one in Indiana that's been going on for years. Every year they get out there and meet up. And I think that's important. We've got to get that started for the vets, because I think if you ask VFWs, Legions, whatever organization, they're not seeing the Gulf War vets out there. They're very few and far between. They're just not out there. And they've become isolated. They have these pains. They are struggling with their families, if their families are still together. I had hoped that we were past suicide, but I'm re-looking at every obit to try to determine if there, you know, unexpected death at home may have been not only a heart attack or a stroke, or it may have been somebody that had the pistol handy and took his life. And that has happened recently, and we're going through that trauma with someone we knew in our groups on Facebook. And they have, besides the chronic fatigue, the fibromyalgia, the Gulf War illness symptoms, they may have other known diagnoses that is going to make it worse if they have MS, ALS, any of the neurological type disorders that are affecting their functioning, even in a home situation. So people and spouses and family members, you know, I don't want to take the guns away from the vets, but if they're down, if they're having troubles with PTSD, if they're having troubles dealing with their life changes, and if there's stress in the family from any factor, you don't need to have that gun out readily available. Put it in a lockbox. Put it in another room. Don't make it so handy, because there's an impulse. And I think if you ask Gulf War vets, I think most of them would admit they've kind of thought about it, not wanting to go on like this and not liking their life. But it's an impulse to end the suffering, and they think their families would be better off. It creates an emptiness in the family and a grief that is much harder to get over than a death by a heart attack or a stroke. Because you question yourself of why didn't you see something, why didn't you do something. And that doesn't just impact the family members, it impacts the veteran community of the emptiness, the questioning of ourselves. You know, did we see something and not engage that person to get some help or to interact more? You second guess everything. And you have that emptiness, you have that desire to not see it happen again. And, you know, people, we need those reunions, those meetups, even if it's only two or three people meeting up to have a cup of coffee or to have a breakfast or a late brunch or go over to a home of somebody that's kind of bunkered in and sit and be with them for a while, have a Coke with them, have a glass of iced tea, whatever, and let them know that they're important. I think that the Vietnam vets, even though they went for a year tour, came back, went over again, like we're seeing with the OIF, OEF, we went over in a given time period, and we came back and life moved on. The units, there was a lot of reorganization going on, just like after Vietnam. But I think it's imperative to encourage people to get together, even if it's a small group at first, until you find another one. If you're going to the VA, you know, take some homemade business cards with you. Hand them out to the ones you meet that are Gulf War vets. Get their info, email, a phone number, and call and invite them. You know, vets, getting together with vets, I think, is probably the best medicine there could be. We understand each other. If you bring your spouses, get them in another room, you know, let them share what they're going through. You know, make it a social setting at first, and then, you know, develop those ties. It's imperative that we get around people that, and when the NGWRC was having meetings, we may have known these people over the phone or by the email, but once we met each other, there's that connection. Whether you never met them in theater, they were there. There's a commonality. And I think that's probably one of the strongest medicines we can have, is not to feel alone, to feel isolated, to be going through this, and even the family members with not getting together. I mean, it's an isolating feeling when you're not feeling good. And we have to make that effort. And then if we do that, maybe we can get more organized and, you know, get with our congressman or our senator and have them come to one of these meetups. Invite them. Don't wait for them to do a town hall. You should also push them to do a town hall. But, you know, invite them to come and to hear and see what the vets are going through, even if you're going to somebody's house. They need to see the vet and the vet's family.
You know, one of the things I think we need to bring up, you know, again, is frustrating. We've discussed suicide on this program before with family members, with parents. We've talked, discussed it with vets that have gone through the situation and made it. But as you get the frustrated, you get the medical problems that are out there, you get frustrated from being involved in the military operations we did, so you're asking all the ethical and moral questions. And when this runs into a problem, ladies and gentlemen, Denise and I have been doing this for a long time. We have been up in the middle of the night where we've activated response teams trying to get help to everybody, and we've done it ourselves way too many. But you need to get
yeah,
help.
We were there before they ever set up a hotline with the VA. We didn't have that.
Yeah, we didn't have the hotline. One thing that we do have, if you're in the central part of the United States, and I want to reinforce this is very, very good. Again, it came about from the work Denise and I have done and others have been done. But the Danville VA, Illiana VA Medical Center, we have the chaplain, Thomas Mills. He's an Air Force veteran, retired out of the Air Force. He's been there, done it. He's got, you know, worked with PTSD stuff. And he's made it very, very loud and clear that if any veteran needs help any place, not only in the central part, Illinois, Indiana, central part of the United States, any around the world, they can call him for help. And he will have chaplains, trained crisis chaplains, that know this information, understand the health and environmental effects that can help you. And, I mean, again, he reemphasized this the other day to me because we had another crisis we were involved in, and Denise is bringing this up tonight because she ran into another crisis situation. But if you need help, you could call the VA chaplain, Thomas Mills, and his phone number for help 24 hours a day, 365, and we call him the pros from Dover, is area code 217-554-3000. I'm going to want to repeat, 217-554-3000. Another phone number is 217-554-4531. Repeat, 217-554-4531. And then we have the 800 number, 1-800-320-8387. So if you're into a crisis, hip into a problem, take heed. I mean, Denise and I, you have to understand, we're only looking out for the best for everybody. But when you have a problem, you need to get help, but you also take these implements away from the, you know, out of reach of the individual. Because the impulse sometimes is really hard to overcome, isn't it, Denise?
Yeah, it's interesting when this occurs that other vets own up to it and admit their close calls or the time they, you know, took all the medicines that were mailed to them and swallowed them. You know, so it's eye-opening to lose one, but yet, it opens the door to others to admit, I've been there. I'm not going to go there again. And if anybody needs to talk, you know, put their phone number out. You know, someone that's been there in that desperation can help one-on-one, whereas they may not trust a hotline number. I have had a lot of vets that don't trust a hotline. They don't want policemen coming out to their house. They're fearful of that.
That's a crisis, because when you have a police officer that doesn't have the knowledge, he's trained, and he's doing his job, and obviously he's, you know, trained very well to do his job, but that's going to trip the crisis over into the other direction where we can all of a sudden have a shootout. And, you know, Or the other thing, too, and we've had this way too often,
suicide
where the veteran actually goes into the situation where he wants the police officer to end the crisis. We've had that happen way too often across the nation.
And, you know, it's a scary situation. And, yes, Doug, you've gotten woken up at night when I've got somebody on the other line trying to get them talking and trying to get help to them that they would accept instead of policemen coming to the door. We've done it all too many times. I feel an emptiness when it happens and they're successful because I know that the pain their family goes through, it doesn't ever leave that family. It's different from a heart attack or a stroke or when a normal disease takes over. Okay, it's different than that. It just is a turmoil that gets carried on. And we've looked at it, and I think psychologists have looked at the ones that have family members that did opt for suicide, and it gets repeated sometimes in families because they feel like, well, I guess that's an accepted method to avoid pain. And
yeah.
I think we have to get the VA to change that attitude, and it's past due. They have to pay attention and not downgrade this to the vet. I've had so many vets complain to me of doctors, be it CMP doctors or anybody, and they're going because they're in pain. They need help. And whether it's a CMP doctor or whoever, to identify that the vet needs to be heard. His problems need to be dealt with. Whether they say it's connected or not, it's a real medical problem, and it should be dealt with. Most of the time when, I think we had 5 years to go in, we'd have free health care. Now we have to be service-connected without them trying to bill us. I think that's wrong. I think if a vet needs help, no matter what war, if they present themselves to the VA and until it's judged that it's not service-connected at all, then the VA ought to step up and take care of the problem. That's why the VA was established in the beginning.
Now, I think that's important because I myself and others and both of us have gone into the VA. We've taken patients in the VA. We've gone in for care ourselves. And when the doctor shows no interest in what happened, you're coming and say, okay, I was over there, I got sprayed by, the nerve agents and everything, the sarin, the cyclosarin, I was closer when they blew up the depots and everything came back on us. Because, this is something that was so critical to understand. And I distinctly remember it was some 10 years after, I think it was in March of 2001, you and I sat one-on-one with General Horner, and we discussed the decision we made in December of 1990 to destroy Iraq's chemical and biological stockpiles in place because the U.S. Army gave them. That's in the Regal Commission report. And I remember back in 1991, we had the discussion. We said, this isn't going to be destroyed. All it's going to do is spread out. And if you remember, and when we're sitting there with General Horner, he confirmed that, and he said, oh, my God, you guys were right from the get-go. All we did is spread it out all over the place, and now everybody is sick. And see, this is a thing that's leading into understanding.
And not only that, Doug, but they set up these registries. And the first one was through the DoD. Second one was VA. And they were supposed to be different phase points. You run them through the basics, then you take them to phase two, phase three. I don't know of many that got through each of the phases, even with the DoD, and then the VA set them up. They have never compiled the data and published the data from the registries. The registry is still available at the VA. You can get a registry exam. It's good to do it. Get you on record even before you put your claim in. There's questionnaires in it and some basic testing. But the vets have complained, why waste my time? Because they have not compiled it. Compiled the results. They never did it. They never published the studies from the registries and what they were finding at the DoD and the VA. And even the DOD registry exams, I know I'm hunting for mine. I had it at Fitzsimmons, and Fitzsimmons closed. Where did they take it to? It was an Army hospital. Is it in the Army archives, medical? You know, they don't put guidance out of if you went to the DOD registry during this time period and at the different places where the records may be that you can request your records from.
Well, you know, the problem we ran into, and you've talked with us on the command staff at 3rd MedCom, and all the records that we did put in the connexes absolutely disappeared coming back from Desert Storm. So the connexes were filled with the medical records when they left Saudi Arabia. But when the colonels, and thank God, I mean, but they're gone to heaven now, Colonel Andres Carnegie Bath and all of them, you know, I mean, they found out the records were all gone. Now, the most frustrating thing for me is, again, total confirmation. This was a big story in the Army Times, that now the 82nd Airborne records have disappeared from OIF, OEF.
Yeah, it's happening again.
I think it's time. The question
to call
is why.
To call out the commanders of each unit, and if they're alive, you put them to the task of, okay, this is your task. These are your people. You had command of them. You're going to take responsibility for pulling this stuff together. If there are records, find them and utilize them. Get a copy back to the individuals. Find them. You know, they never did that. The Office of Special Investigation never pulled in all the commanders and involved them in the process.
You attempted at a conference several years ago in Dallas to have the 3rd Medical Command staff come down and talk before everybody at a conference in Dallas. And that all, the VA shot that all completely apart because they did not want 3rd MedCom staff to come in there and testify as what's happened. And then right after that, Runge is gone now. He's dead. Sergeant Major Runge is dead. Colonel Andres Carnegie Bath is dead. As far as we know, Colonel Tom is gone. And all of these other ones, so it's very severe. Rollo's memory is affected. Everybody's memory is affected.
But,
so,
I mean, the senior command, if they're still alive, and a lot of more Vietnam, too, so we've lost Dorman Norman, we've lost Carini, we've lost a lot of people, but they're all not gone, okay? And I think that we have to call them forward. David Winnett did his number at the IOM meeting calling out for any of the senior ranking. And that means senior NCOs, too, should step forward and get involved and help before it's too late. You know, it's probably a little bit too late already, but I'm putting out the call. I've done it before. David Winnett diverted from what he was saying at the IOM to call him out. The troops are out there, and when the leaders do not take effective steps, you lose all faith and trust in the government that you served. Put your hand forward, swore an oath, took the oath, whether you were enlisted NCO, officer, what have you.
You know, we need to come back. You're doing the medical, and this is frustrating because we got all this exposure, and this goes back to what we're talking about, the nerve agents and the other exposures. But the Department of Defense Form 2796, the post-deployment physical assessment form, hopefully you did that when you were coming back from deployment. It was supposed to be done. It's supposed to be put in your medical records. We know the GAO's confirmed a lot have disappeared.
Only that, but a lot of reserves were activated. The reserves did not go back through that. When they brought them home, they did not bring them right back into the medical facility and run them through. Take blood samples, urine samples, what have you. They failed us. There is no other word.
You know, so get that, you know, the DD 2796, and we've made a strong emphasis, and I do the same thing, as your health status changes, because these exposures result not just in immediate health effects, but long-term health effects, and health effects that start showing up when you get another exposure. The nerve agents exposures, from everything confirmed, absolutely did happen. When you get another pesticide exposure from agricultural pesticides or household pesticides, can trigger that stuff. So now you get a little bit and get zapped again, and now you go into a crisis mode. So again, this is extraordinarily important. One thing, and you mentioned it a moment ago, Denise, and I don't know if you've seen it there, U.S. Marine Corps Captain David Winnett Have you seen the new poem that David wrote yet?
Yes, I did. His poems are so...
David Wynette, and I'd like, with David's permission, he sent it to me. I'd like to read this right now for everybody. David is an incredible U.S. Marine, served many, many years and everything. He's still a U.S. Marine fighting for all the veterans. And this is brand new. This is from Captain David Wynette, United States Marine Corps. And this takes a couple of minutes to read, but I think it's important. Family Tree. The warrior's veins run deep. His blood runs red and fast, shed for generations past, father, brothers, and sons. Freedom's burden carried for all and everyone. Tradition passed along through DNA. They fought back then. They fight today as little as they. Each night they kneel and pray. Dying willingly, it's in the family tree. Proud Americans, they stand their ground, and yours their calling always been. Your dirty chore of war. Coming home again, the cycle never ends. One generation more to fight. Horrid cries that last all night. The same old tune. Echoes decades throughout every room. A house of warriors too proud to see the light. One son gone to war, one briefly home once more. As a father proudly fades and dies, family pride runs high. They ask for a little back, perhaps a burial plot beside the metro track. Their souls can freely cry out loud, another death that's proud. A flag remembers each, a reverence, lonely graveyard speech, duly, proudly done by all. The family tree stands tall. Scars of war passed along to yet another son. Tradition never dies despite their anguish cries. Duty and honor call, the family sacrifices all. The son is off to war again, a family to the end. Turn out the lights and lock the door, for after him, the family tree may be no more. This is from Captain David Wynette, retired United States Marine Corps. I mean, an incredible individual. And he wrote that poem, and we talked about this last week on the show, for Trooper. Again, seeing the pain and the anguish of all of us, and again, we're talking about the pain and the anguish that's existing, and suicides and everything came back. So we need to remember this. David, thank you. God bless you, and thank you for an incredible, incredible poem that you've added to the heritage and the literature of our thing. Wow.
He puts out poems that are just, it takes your breath away. He's put out two, I think, this last week. And like we said, people write your experiences. I've got a Facebook site encouraging blogs. Get it out to the public. I want to encourage the veterans, the family members, to, when you go into the VA, speak up. If you have a doctor that's just putting you down, you can change your doctor, but you need to notify the administration of this attitude. And I think a letter should go to the medical staff director of each of the VA hospitals, and a copy of that should be sent to VA headquarters in D.C. This has got to stop. It won't stop until we stand up and say, this doctor has no feelings, no empathy, no curiosity of why this is happening to me. He's not looking for things to help me. You need to speak up. You need to, approach the administration, approach the chaplain, and say, we need a meetup. Can the VA facilitate this by donating a room once every couple of months and have your doctors and providers come and attend? And let the veterans have their say, form a task force for that VA hospital is hopefully the end result to make change happen. It's not just about each and every one of us. It's about the whole group of us. And, I remember ages ago when I was in nursing school and they were heavy into change agent. I still remember that. And I'm going, yeah, you're coming out as a new nurse and you're wanting us to be change agents. Well, I'm taking it forward. I'm playing it forward and saying patience. I also went through the time, with my master's degree and all of paying attention to patient education before it wasn't common. to do all the patient education for open heart surgery patients or MI patients, heart attack patients, much less any other problem. Since then, we have amended hearts. We, you know, have a lot more education going on in civilian hospitals. I don't see that reaching the VA hospitals, and it's a crying shame. It doesn't take that much to listen to your patients, your clients, if you want to call them that. The new term was client and provider and all those things. But I go back, a patient is a patient. They're there because they're sick. They need help. They need education. They need the listening ear of healthcare professionals. But it's a shared duty, people. And each one of us that speak out, everybody should be doing this. Speak out. Ask the chaplain. Ask the chaplain to help you get a meeting at the VA where all the Gulf War vets that are going to that VA are notified. They can do it for free, okay? Much easier than the vets can to try to rent a hotel room or something to get people together. But it's critical, and it's something that needs to be done, and we can make a change that will help future generations and the past generations.
You know, this,
the Vietnam vets worked and got the vet centers up because they had such a tremendous problem with PTSD. They stand as a monument to the Vietnam vets that made that happen. The reunions the Vietnam vets got out there and did, the Rolling Thunder effort across the nation and taking in people that aren't just vets that ride with them, and the new vets. This is tremendously needed, and it takes each of us to use our voices to make it happen. You have done a lot of work up in Illinois. I've tried, you know, I've reached out to the University of Colorado, took the RAC reports over to the vice chancellor and said, please get people involved in the research. But we're one person wherever we are. And we need to use a military term. We need to force multiply that. And each and every vet, each and every spouse, family member can have an impact. And that's what we need to do. What can they do? Send you back to Saudi? No.
Yeah, we had that story. Well, you
can
know,
they
we
say
talk-
no? Yes, they can say no, but you don't give up. You try again using a different source.
Yeah.
If you try with the administrator and you turn to the chaplain, maybe they can get it done. You find a friendly, you know, be a nurse provider that would help from within the system to convince them to do it. There's too much isolation of our vets once we come back, for sure with the reserves that go. Once they're out and in the community, there's a disconnect. Now, our Iraqi vets and Afghanistani vets, that happened after 9/11, it's a little bit different. They got organized early on, and they're forced to be dealt with, but they're not accepting the pre-9/11, and we need to make changes. We need to all come together. We need to make changes in the system instead of being frustrated and talking about it on Facebook. Or, you know, getting on the phone with somebody and saying, my CMP only lasted 20 minutes and they really didn't do a good job. Whoa, you know, you got to go back to that facility and make a difference. And now it takes a little effort, but maybe that little difference will impact you and will impact a larger number.
Okay, I'm going to come back to what we started to have this discussion with, because one of the things that frightens me, and I've seen this too often, we're running headlong into war again. And part of the discussion and everything is the claim that chemical agents and poison gas was used in Syria. Again, when we looked at the video evidence of what they presented so far, knowing how these agents work, there's no indication that's happened. One of the things that we have to understand with nerve agents and everything else, this stuff is a liquid, it's not a gas. And as we know from the exposure, once it gets onto the individual, and Denise, you ran into this problem where we get cross-contamination, you have to totally decontaminate the person. The stuff is not going to degrade right away and everything else, so it's going to remain there and it's going to transfer. So one of the things that I've seen on TV, and this bothers me, I've not been there, so I don't know, but what we do know how it functions and how it works, is they're claiming that the nerve agent was used or something like this, and they claim it's poison gas. It's not. It's a liquid. The other thing, too, they're showing the individuals going right up to them without the other individuals getting sick immediately, which is what would happen with cross-contamination. So if they have any of these agents that are used, obviously, you know, they go a long distance. There's detection. The detection kits that we have available, the M256, the CAM, the M8 paper, the M9 paper, and M8 tape, the M8 alarm systems. All this stuff is out there to verify that's happening. Decontamination. Recently, there's been a lot of stuff, and I've seen on TV, they've done some exercises in Illinois where these individuals are trying to decontaminate in a truck. Basically, what they've got is a truck that's not even as big as a semi. They pull it up. They claim they're going to be able to decontaminate. So you walk in a door, and one end of the truck is all contained, all together, and you walk out the other end of the door and be decontaminated. Ladies and gentlemen, we disposed of these things in Saudi Arabia back in 1990. Was one of the ways Bowers Raiders ever again, they sold these decontamination trunks to the royal family in Saudi Arabia and the command staff and said, well, just park these here. Once something happens, you run through this and get decontaminated. Totally impossible. What I want to make a reference to is, and we've talked about this, I know it's been on discussions on the Internet and on Facebook, the Medical Management Chemical Casualties Handbook, again, put out by Aberdeen Proving Ground, Maryland. In there for the decontamination, to outline the decontamination station. The other thing that you can get a hold of is the Medical NBC Battle Book. This is a CHIPM Technical Guide 244. I mean, all of Bowers Raiders, we were involved in putting this criteria together. A decontamination station, when you come in basically and do a triage. Are they alive or are they dead? If they're expectant or dying, you just throw them into the pit, dirty dump. You put some lime on them and you let them die, or you come back to them later on. This is all in a contaminated area. From the triage point to the dirty dump is 75 yards. From the dirty dump to the first casualty decon station is another 75 yards. So we're talking about areas multiple football lengths in size. And the problem you run into, and this is where this idea of a truck is nonsense, you have to come in. They're totally contaminated. You can't separate the contamination out. Any area that you walk on gets contaminated. The stuff is blowing in. The wind gets contaminated. So you have to break this down and completely strip the individual down. You have to completely saturate them and clean them in decontamination. And that takes incredible stuff where Palmolive or Joy dish soap, wash every inch of the body down, cut the hair all off, clean under the fingernails, completely decontaminate them. The clothes have to be disposed of. The stuff doesn't go away. One of the problems we ran into when we did the research and everything is the clothes got contaminated, and we learned there was no way to clean the clothes. So once they're contaminated, and this goes back to, again for me, putting up the warning flags of what they're claiming in Syria did not happen because they're not doing any of this, and yet we don't see any additional contamination or medical problems. Once you get through that, you're still on the dirty side of everything. You've got the casualty decon. You've done some emergency medical treatment to stabilize them. They're stripped down to everything. They go through what's called a shuffle pit, and then we got another 50 yards or so where we get into the entire clean, you know, treatment and decontamination stations. So it's a very large area. These corporations, companies, local fire and police departments somehow bought this idea. Well, we'll buy this decontamination truck, and I've seen it here on the TV and news, and I've seen it in use locally. Ladies and gentlemen, this is going to get you dead. And you need to understand what is involved in everything on this stuff is very, very critical. The same thing with the medical care and treatment, any nerve agents. So you've got to administer atropine, pyridoxine chloride, and diazepam rapidly. And we're not talking about one dose, Denise, are we? We're talking about multiple doses until they stabilize.
Right.
And it's not easy to administer, is it?
Got to have an IV in to flush their system as well as you can with massive IVs, too.
Yeah, so you have all these problems. Obviously, you're stabilizing the respiratory. But again, some of the things they've showed them, and then all of a sudden they're coming back. Well, this isn't going to happen. So we got to put the warnings out. A problem we ran into before and what has happened where the stuff was used, we have to understand that the U.S. Army, and I was involved in this, writing our doctrine and our medical protocols and teaching during Desert Storm, we got all of that from Field Manual FM 8-285, Medical Management. That's the main manual. All these other books are additional to this. But again, that was developed because of the fact that we gave Iraq the chemical and biological weapons to use on the Iranians. And this whole list of stuff is in the Regal Commission report that Jimmy Two did, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
People don't want to look at that. And so this is very, very important to understand what is happening and what is being done. One of the things that I learned being the chemical, biological, one of the team with all the knowledge, we never heard of Syria having any of this before. That doesn't mean they don't, but it never came up before this all showed up. But we need to take hesitation and warnings and everything, because Israel absolutely has it. Iraq, you know, we destroyed all the stuff they had. Who knows what Iran has, all the other areas in these nations. God knows what will happen if everything comes unglued. And this terrifies me, because absolutely terrifies me, because then if we have an event or a problem over there and we get an event triggered over here within the United States, we're totally, completely unprepared. I mean, I wish that we could have the training up there. Denise, you and I were instrumental in getting training done during Desert Storm. We were instrumental in getting training done after Desert Storm, and it's still broken. The troops don't have the knowledge. They don't have the equipment. They don't know what's going on, and yet they're put into a risk area, and then they're told inaccurate information that could help save their life if they had accurate information. And the doctors and the nurses must be given the accurate information. It's in the manuals. It's in the courses that we taught, but somehow it didn't get to them, did it?
No, sure it didn't.
You were up there on the front line at a medevac station, and you and I didn't meet each other until years later. Even though we taught the medical management chemical biological casualty course during Desert Storm, you never saw that course, did you?
I'm not sure. You know, I came through Riyadh, and you were doing courses there.
Yeah, but as far as on the front line, there was nothing done.
No. I mean, once we left Riyadh and went to KKMC and then went forward to our location was Log Base Charlie on Taplime Road between Haffa al-Batin and Rafah. And so, you know, we had kind of a quick refresher there at Riyadh, and I think almost every person that came in to see Aider through Riyadh, I know, got
they did get the refresher. They got the refresher we were
and
doing.
And I know that we did refresher training when we got activated, besides packing up all the supplies, since we provided all the mobile staging facilities, we provided the medical service officers, we provided the radio operators that would go forward as a team of three. We'd have a medical service officer and two radio operators up with the Army that would initiate the what we called the alpha message, which went back to CENTCOM to coordinate with them that when the planes came in, like, you know, 130s, they offloaded cargo, and then, you know, we'd have message and coordination so that we would use that aircraft for the backhaul capability and turn it into the flying medical plane, bringing in, you know, putting down the straps and getting the litters brought in and all the equipment. So I know that before we even left Kelly, I know we were having refreshers on the suits and everything else. I mean, we tried to do as much as we could, rebriefing people despite the normal requirements of having it annually. You know, they were brought in, and, you know, we squeezed in as much as we could while we were taking care of multiple tasks, getting ready to leave Kelly and going into theater. So there was a lot of refresher courses, but, you know, one of the things that came up when I got home was no one had ever talked about depleted uranium. No one had ever talked about low-level chemical exposure. The PB tablets weren't, I don't even think they were in the Air Force manual. We got them issued to us. Later I found out in the Army manual it talked about using protostigmine bromide, the PB tablets, in the Army manuals, but it specified for SOMAN, not Theron, Lewisite, and all the others. So I know that once we came home, there was an effort to upgrade the training. I got out in 93, so I don't know how far that upgrade in training became after that point.
Well, some of it we continued. We, you know, put it together at the U.S. Army Chemical School and through the Army Reserve, and we had the 120-city program. But again, we still find out, and again, talking to the veterans, they haven't had the training. I know veterans have been deployed recently and came back recently. They didn't get any of the three tiers of training on depleted uranium that is mandated.
And everything we've done over 23 years, and we have new people coming into Facebook pages all the time, and it's like some of the things older than a year, and even going back further, that they have never seen. You know, there was those of us that were digging. The first group of vets, I guess, did a whole lot of digging, freedom of information, digging for things. And we were sharing as much as we could with new websites being developed and Yahoo message groups. But we didn't, you know, there was no way we could grab everybody. We were out there trying to grab them, you know, if we found them. But they're coming on Facebook now, and it's amazing. You know, they're questioning, you know, what happened, you know. And don't know to go read the Regal Report. Don't know to go read the Rockefeller. Don't know to follow up with the lack of action or the misaction by the Institute of Medicine, National Academy of Science, much less catch up with what the Research Advisory Committee and other medical researchers have shown for it.
Well, we're running out of time.
I hear the music coming up, Doug. I want to mention that we have 14 vets that have died last week. We're up to, I think, 22.
Incredible. Ladies and gentlemen, our plan for next week is we're going to have a radio show on World War II's famed legendary Tuskegee Airmen. So please listen in as we discuss the Tuskegee Airmen in preparation for the Red Tails event at the Chanute Air Museum in Rantoul, Illinois. You can go to aeromuseum.org to find all about that. Well, ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much. Denise, thank you. Take heed, ladies and gentlemen. God bless America. David Wynette, Captain, God bless you, and thank you for an incredible poem added to the literature of the military. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen.